Gary, my name's John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
I've been sober since May 16th of 2005. I have a sponsor. I have a home group, which is the Midtown Group. We meet on Sunday nights in normally in Bethesda, Maryland, but we're currently meeting in Rockville, Maryland, at 7:30 p.m. So tonight's usually I'm at my home group, and but I appreciate the invite to come down here. I've come down here before, and I know Billy and Sam. Thank you for having me to come down, having me out here. I want to, before I forget, to thank my friend Orhan, who came down with me. Orhan and I have been good friends in the program for some years, and sometimes he'll tag along with me, and I'll tag along with him. So thank you for making the trip down here with me, man. It was good to spend some time with you. And Sam, I just want to say, I wanted to just put this out there. Sam, if you've ever got a text from Sam, Sam's got his emoji game on point with the messages. He really has got the smiley faces and the thumbs up. I love it. So thank you, man. Thank you. I love it, man. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking on the way down here and kind of just sitting here listening to the reading, you know, AA truly is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. It is the greatest gift I've ever been given. If it wasn't for AA, I don't know if I'd be alive. I don't want to go that far, but I definitely know that I would be dead on the inside. I would not be awake like I am today. I would not have had a spiritual experience. I would be suffering with my alcoholism, and really what I would have been suffering with is selfishness and self-centeredness that would have just destroyed me on the inside. And so I'm very grateful, and I know that today, that AA is such a gift. And if you're new to AA, welcome. I can tell you I did not feel like that when I first started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I definitely didn't feel like that. I felt nothing like that. I was very judgmental of all of you. I felt very... I was a glasses half empty kind of guy. I was somebody who thought there was no way out of the situation I was in. My solution was not the solution you were suggesting to me. It was something a lot more what I thought was realistic in a funny way. It was like, look, just let me not go back to jail here on this violation of probation. Let me get my license back. Let me just get back at that job I had where I was getting good overtime. Let me just get the girl back. Let me get all these things back in my life that I thought were going to make me happy. And your solution was a little bit different. It was almost backwards in a way. You know, it was like, let's just not think about that stuff for a minute. Let's try to get better spiritually. And then all that other stuff can come along and get better. And I did not like that. You know, so if you're new and you're kind of in that spot and they suggest getting a sponsor and you get this sponsor and he starts giving you suggestions and sharing their experience and it's not what you think, that's okay. You know, that was my experience. I definitely came here, you know, and had to be willing to try something different. So I grew up, I still live in Montgomery County, Maryland. I grew up in Rockville, if anybody's familiar with that area up there. I know some of you are. I had two parents who got divorced when I was young. A lot of alcoholism and mental illness in my family. My father's side, Irish Catholic. My father had six sisters and a brother. I can tell you that to this day, you know, the ones that are still alive, they either they're an alcoholic or they're borderline. You know what I mean? You might think they were. Mental illness, schizophrenia. You know, I've got an aunt who's, you know, very mentally ill. Several others who have other issues. You know, and then there's my mother's side of the family. My mother, a lot of mental illness on her side of the family. So I basically was not, you know, when I was sort of growing up, I was not set up for success from a genetics standpoint. Let's just say that. You know, it was like it was right there. You know, and I can remember growing up, my father's family would get together on holidays like Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and we would have these big get-togethers. And as a child, I just remember problems. You know, I remember my uncle having a grand mal seizure on the floor at the Christmas party, you know, because he had decided to stop drinking a couple days before Christmas. You know, I can remember the fights that would happen. You know, I can remember the way my father would look when he got there, and I can remember the way he would look and act when we were leaving. His eyes would be glassy and red. His face would get red. He would be smiling a lot. You know, he'd probably be handing me money or something, you know, part of me was okay with it. It was nice to not have that father kind of breathing down your throat the way he might normally be. But the other side of it, I was terrified, you know, because we had to drive 30, 40 minutes home, you know, and my father would be so drunk that I would be yelling at him to get back on the right side of the road. He would cross over medians onto the wrong side of the road, and this is how I grew up, you know. And my parents would fight. They would inevitably get separated and get divorced, you know. And so that was kind of what I saw as a child growing up. Nobody told me about alcoholism. I didn't know that drinking was really a problem. It didn't even cross my mind that people even really had drinking problems. I just knew that when my father drank, bad things happened. My mother had these illnesses where she was at the hospital. She was on a lot of different anxiety medications and was having these panic attacks. And I remember all that, you know. And if you had met me prior to about the age of 14 or 15, you would have thought I was a really good kid. You know, I got good grades. I played a lot of sports. I had a lot of friends. I went out with all the pretty girls. I was a popular kid. You know, things were looking up. I was the kind of kid that you would want your kid hanging out with. You know, I was like, all right, you can go hang out with John. You know, oh, I was out with John. No worry about what we were going to be doing. You know, somewhere along the line there, something changed. And I don't know exactly what it was, but I just know that I kind of made a decision to start associating with some different people. I went from associating with the kids who were getting good grades to the kids who were skipping class. I went from being, you know, in the front row where the teacher could see me and I could raise my hand to wanting to sit in the back row. I went from, you know, really caring about athletics and what teams I played on and if I was going, you know, showing up to practice, to being somebody who slowly, one by one, dropped every sport that I was playing till there was really no sports left, you know. Somewhere in there, when you start hanging out with those kind of people and you start dropping these positive things in your life, you're going to come across some of these negative things. And one of them for me was drugs and alcohol. You know, I found myself in middle school kind of turning towards that stuff, you know. And let's just say this. By the time I got into high school, I was not the kid you wanted your kid hanging out with. I was when I turned 16 years old, I got a vehicle that I was driving, and my car just stopped kind of going to high school in the morning, you know. It would just kind of go the other direction, you know. And I'd be the guy picking up maybe somebody at school, but we weren't going to school, you know. And I would you know, okay, I'll say this. At the age of 16, I came home one day from skipping school to find my mother on the front lawn, and she was crying. And I said, "Mom, you're making a scene. What are you doing out here on the lawn?" And she said, "The house is on fire." And I said, "I don't see a fire." And I went around the side of the house, and I saw some flames. I tried to run in the front door, and I got blown back off the porch because the whole house was basically like an oven at this point. I just couldn't see it on the outside. And I watched as I heard the sirens coming down the road. By the time the police got there, the whole left side of the house was engulfed in flames, and our house basically was destroyed. And this was at age 16. And I was hanging on at that point to school. We moved. We received some money to move into an apartment while they were rebuilding our home. And during that time, I just decided to stop going to high school altogether. And that was really where my life changed. I can say it was at that point that I discovered alcohol. My mother, you know, after she and my father had gotten divorced, she tended to like dating younger men. So she would date these guys. She was in her 40s, you know. She would date these guys in their 20s, you know. And so me and my friends were hanging out, and she was dating these guys. And she was dating this one guy, and we called him Jesus because he literally had long hair and a beard. He looked just like Jesus. So we called him Jesus, except he drove a 1970-something pickup truck, Chevy pickup truck. And Jesus was the kind of guy who would come home at night and the whole left side of his truck would just be smashed in, you know, be both side panels, the front panel. And you'd be like, "Jesus, what happened to your truck?" And he'd be like, "I don't know." You know, at that time I didn't realize Jesus was experiencing what I would soon experience, blackouts, you know. And so Jesus wouldn't remember what happened to his truck. Maybe, you know, a week later we'd see that maroon color on his truck on the side of a dumpster, on, you know, we'd be like, "That's what happened to Jesus's truck," you know. And so Jesus came home one night with a couple of fifths of vodka, and I had yet to get drunk, and here I am. Jesus starts pouring drinks for my mom. And my mom was the kind of mom who let me and my brother do whatever we wanted to do. I don't know if it was because she wasn't sure how else to love us or what it was, but that's what it was. You know, my house was that house. You might have had a friend like me. I was the guy who you could go over to my house and my mom was okay with you drinking in the basement and hanging out, maybe smoking some weed. She didn't care, you know. And so I'm sitting here and I get drunk for the first time, you know, and it changed my life. It changed my life. I will tell you this. I got sick for the first time that night. I threw up for the first time from drinking that night. I remember I said my first prayer that night. I hadn't really been raised with a lot of religious background, and I remember praying to God that night, asking him to make this feeling go away. It would be the first of many foxhole prayers, because followed up with that prayer was, I promise I'll never drink again, you know. And so I remember that, but I also remember that, you know, I remember that. And I remember after that continuing to seek that out and drink and drink and drink. And the priorities had fully shifted in my life from school and success to what can I do to have fun, you know. And I wish, I look back on it and I can't imagine how I was so clueless to think that I was going to go without high school, without a college degree, or without any type of training to succeed and become anything in life. It didn't even cross my mind. I literally was so happy that I had found this relief that I would seek that out every day, going against everything anybody said to me. My family, judges, police officers, lawyers, counselors, psychiatrists, drug counselors, inpatient treatment counselors, you name it. I would give everything away. I would lose everything in my life. And when they told me I should do something different, I could care less what they said. You know, and that was my life. I will say this, I got sober at a very young age. I got sober at the age of 22. But what I'm going to tell you, between the age of 16 and 22, hopefully you'll see that it was a very good thing that I'm not out driving on your streets right now under the influence. I went on from there to almost become a daily drinker right away. I dropped out of high school. I applied for one job. I didn't get it, so I turned to theft, stealing from my family, stealing from whoever I could to have the life I wanted to have. And I mentioned my parents were divorced, so at this point I could, I don't know if anybody else experienced this, but I kind of had this like 1-2 kind of thing I would do. You know, if mom was mad at me, I would go to stay with dad. If dad was mad at me, I would go to stay with mom. And I became a blackout drunk. I was somebody who would go out every day and I would get drunk and I would drive. I loved to drive. And I started getting put on all types of medications, and that would just increase the chance of me blacking out, that it would increase the chance of me doing things that were strange and kind of wild. I was somebody who, at first, when I would black out, you know, you hear the stories the next day, like, John, you were so funny last night, you took your clothes off, you ran around in circles, you know, you did this, and then it just turned to something else. You know, it went from that to being this kind of, do you know what you did last night? You know, I can't believe you said that to that person. I can't believe you did that. You know, and I would slowly back out of relationships that I had, whether it was friends, family, girlfriends. I would slowly just back my way out of all these relationships. And my life got really small, You know, and I didn't realize at this point that, you know, I had noticed the sacrifice and the giving up of the school and stuff like that, but I didn't realize that I was already starting to suffer from some of the symptoms of alcoholism. I was already making promises to people I couldn't keep. I was already making oaths, swearing off drinking, or at least the amount that I drank as a teenager. I remember specifically embarrassing people, like my girlfriend. I would go to a party and I would embarrass her in front of all of her friends at a college party or something, and she would say, John, last night, you know, you did this, this, and this, and you know, normally what would happen is they would be having another party, and I would say, hey, can I come to the party tonight? And she'd be like, they don't want you there. They don't want you to come. You know, and I would say, why? She'd say, well, last time you did this, this, you insulted my friend, you got in a fight with my friend, and they said, you know, that I could come, but I can't bring you. And I would get really upset, you know. More than anything, I just cared what people thought about me. I wanted to look good, but I also didn't want to miss out on the free alcohol at the party, you know. So what I would do is mean it with everything in me. I would say, I'm so sorry. I promise you tonight I'm only going to have one beer just to hold something in my hand. You can't go to a party and not hold a drink in your hand, you know. So I'm just going to have that one drink. And I would go to this party. Sure enough, I'd have that one beer, and then something would change in me. Something would switch, and I would mean it with everything in me. I did not want to embarrass myself again. I did not want to be that guy. And the next thing you know, they're kicking me out of the party again. You know, I was thinking, I got sober young, and I didn't really start going to bars until I was in my 20s. I think I got kicked out of every bar I ever went to. Every time I went to a bar, I got kicked out. I was that much of a, what our literature describes as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type drinker, that when you met me during the day, it was almost like a, it's almost like a werewolf in a way. You know, you meet me during the day, you think I was a nice guy, you invite me into your house, and by the time the moon comes out, you're like, who is this guy? This is not the guy that I met earlier. And so, as you can imagine, like I said, my life got smaller and smaller, and the only people that would really spend time with me were my family, because they loved me and they wanted to help me. Maybe a couple of friends who I would call lower companions, but eventually I would end up being the lower companion and would have to find some even lower companions, you know. And so I got to the age of 18 and I started getting arrested, go figure, for drinking and driving. And my first DWI at the age of 18 resulted in me getting 3 years back, 3 years of a 3 year sentence, because I also punched the arresting officer in the face. And I got him pretty good. And I'll never forget going to court that day and seeing the pictures of the officer and having the four police officers standing over here describing the situation, and my attorney just looking at me and saying, "You didn't tell me all that." And I was like, "I don't remember all that, you know." And so I end up getting this sentence of 3 years. The judge looks at me, and my parents have this high paid lawyer they got for me. And he says, "You know, son, since it's your first offense, your first conviction as an adult, I'm going to suspend all of it. I'm going to put you on this very strict probation. And if I see you again, I'm going to give you all of it, all 3 years." And we walked out of the courtroom, and my attorney looked at me and he said, "John, if you ever drink again, it's the stupidest thing you've ever done in your life." And I looked at him, I said, "I'm never going to drink again." And I meant it again with everything in me. And this is what I didn't know about alcoholism. I didn't understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. I would have told you that my alcoholism was the DWI. I would have told you the alcoholism was the fact that I was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was a crazy person when I drank. I would have told you it was because I blacked out. I would have told you it's because I drank a lot and I drank every day. I would have told you it was because I wet the bed or I was this way or that way when I drank. The truth is what my alcoholism is right here what happened when I got out of our courtroom. I looked at my attorney and I said, "I'll never drink again." And a week later, I was drinking and driving. And what is that? You know, our book, our steps call it insanity, really. It's insanity. If any normal person was to see my life, to see the consequences I've suffered, starting from when I first started drinking, even till that point, and they said, "What do you think?" You asked them, "What do you think the best thing that this kid could do?" They would have said, "But just to not drink anymore. His life would probably improve." Any normal person. And they say, "What do you think the worst thing this kid could do?" "Drink and drive again, probably." And if you showed them a video of me a week later drinking and driving with a 30-pack on my front seat, screaming, you know, out the window at somebody, you'd think, "That guy's insane. That guy's crazy." And that is my alcoholism. And that's what I didn't get, because it was shortly after that I first got introduced to AA, and people would talk about this kind of stuff in the meetings, and I would say, I don't know what you're talking about. I know I have a problem and I know I can stop, but I don't need your help. And what I found over the next 4 years of drinking and getting my second DWI at the age of 19, my third DWI at the age of 20, and my second assault on a police officer at the age of 21 when I punched another cop, I found that I was unable to stop on my own. Regardless of how bad it had been before, regardless of the upcoming consequences I might be facing and the potential for prison or whatever else it was, the potential to kill somebody on the road, it was never going to be enough. On my own, I was always going to return to alcohol again. And I know this because between the age of 19 and 21, I started to fall asleep behind the wheel, driving on highways. I came to one night at 70 miles an hour on Route 50, slamming into a Jersey wall. Regained control of the car, parked for an hour, and started driving again. That's the kind of stuff that might make somebody think about stopping drinking. One night I came to and I had driven up on the sidewalk in front of the University of Maryland College in College Park, Maryland. I could have ran over 15 students. Didn't stop me from drinking and driving. That's the kind of person I am when I drink. I cannot stop. And at the end, you know, near the end of my drinking, I was somebody who every Friday I would get a check and I would have that thought, maybe I should just go to the gun store instead of the beer store, you know, and I can end all of this. You know, I had gotten to that point with the amount of pain and anguish and suffering and the guilt and shame that I felt to think that every week that I wanted to end my life. Yet for some reason, I continued to drink. For some reason, knowing there was help available, I continued to drink. You know, and I found myself at the age of 21. You know, I'll tell you the story about how I punched the second cop. I found myself on, you know, I was working this dead-end labor job. It was a blue-collar job. I was out in the sun all day. I wasn't getting paid much. I get a lot of overtime. I get paid every Friday, and by this point, I was unable to have a bank account with any of the major banks in America because I had overdrafted so much money from them, and they all, I guess at some point, they started cooperating with each other, and they would get your name on this list, you know. So I would try to get a bank account, and I couldn't. So here I am at the easy check cash spot, you know, and I'm cashing this check, and they're taking whatever their rake right off the top of that, and I'm going to the beer store, and I'm buying enough for me to get through the weekend, and by Monday morning I'd be broke, you know. And this was my life, every week repeating this cycle over and over and over and over again. I could barely sleep at night with as much as I was drinking sometimes, you know, and I was alone. My father was letting me live in his home rent-free. The only reason was because he didn't know what else to do with me. He basically was watching his son kill himself. My brother, who lived there with us, who was my younger brother, again, that shame, that guilt of not being able to be an example for my younger brother, he moved out of the home because I was stealing from him. I was getting violent in the house, and he couldn't stand to watch his brother kill himself. And he left, you know. I ended up having a Friday and a Monday off work, and I don't know about anybody else, but days off were my favorite because I didn't have to worry about stopping drinking when I woke up. I would drink all night, I'd pass out, and when I woke up, whether it was 4 in the morning or 8 in the morning, I'd start drinking again, you know, and I had been doing that for 4 days straight, and I found myself on a Monday walking back to the beer store, and they refused to sell me any more alcohol. And I don't, you know, it's funny, they probably saved my life that day. There wasn't any reason for them to do that other than I think they just saw me as somebody who they didn't want to continue doing what he was doing, you know. And I caused the scene, of course. It was a 7-Eleven, and everybody's in there getting their hot dogs and their Slurpees or whatever, their 59-ounce glasses, you know, Coke. And here I am trying to buy alcohol, and they said no. And I proceeded to verbally assault the people at the 7-Eleven, and to the point where they called the police. And there's one thing I said I was never going to do again. It was hit another armed man. But here I was walking out of the 7-Eleven facing these two officers, and I just started fighting, you know. And they took me to jail again that day, and I found myself sitting in jail with nobody to call. There wasn't a person left on this earth who was going to bail me out of jail. And so I sat there. I sat there on a very small bond for 32 days, every day, questioning my life, questioning my decisions, questioning how I had gotten here, the age of 21, into turning, I turned 22 in jail, and I was questioning my life. And I remember thinking, when I get out of here, I'm not going to drink anymore, I'm going to turn this around. I got out of jail 32 days later. The first call I made was to my mother, and I said, Mom, I'm 30. Well, it was 7 days after I got out. I went to see my probation officer, and she said, congratulations, you just violated, and I'm sending you back to jail. And I left there, and I called my mother, and I said, Mom, I'm 39 days sober, and I'm feeling good. And I could hear it in her voice. She said, that's good, son. She didn't believe me. I got off the phone with my mother, and I looked to my right, and there was a liquor store. And I thought this. You just got told you're going back to jail. You're sleeping on your grandfather's living room floor. You don't have a job. You got no money. There's only one thing that smooths those edges. And let's not get a fifth here or anything. Let's not even get a pint. Let's just get one of those little miniatures that you get on an airplane, you know? Just one. I just need something to calm my nerves. As I walked into that liquor store, there's a story in the book I'm sure you guys are familiar with with Jim, who ends up at the roadside diner, and he has that feeling like he's not being too smart, you know. And I had that feeling as I walked into that liquor store. And if you're anything like me, you probably know what happened after I got that miniature of vodka. There's another liquor store a little further up the pike there where I live, and I got a fifth. And there's another liquor store a little bit further up. I got a half gallon. I slept in the woods that night because there was one rule at my grandfather's house, and you can probably imagine what that rule was: no drinking. Slept in the woods that night, ended up in a cheap motel, staying there until they kicked the door in and kicked me out for not paying my bill. And I stepped one notch lower. You know, I was 22 years old, and I was a total loser. I was a failure. My family wasn't talking to me. I was having panic attacks when I wasn't drunk because I didn't have any medication or any money or anything to make me feel better like I used to. And I had nothing. What ended up happening to me is I ended up getting this job back. And one day I ran into a guy. And I ran into a guy. Let me just say this real quick. From the time I was 18 to 22, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You might have them here. I was one of those young guys. I would show up at the meeting. I might stick around for a month. You know, I might get a sponsor. I might do a couple of the things he says. But eventually, I just start to fade. You know, and then you don't see me for a week. You don't see me the next week. And then you don't hear from me anymore. And then I'm gone. And then you hear the stories. You know, oh, guess what happened to John? You know, John got arrested again. This happened to John. So I was in and out of AA, and I say that to just tell you this. I ran into a guy who I had actually referred to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if anybody else has done that, but I was a great advocate for AA when I was out there drinking, you know, because AA was your solution. It was going to work for you. It wasn't going to work for me, but it was going to work for you. So I would refer people to AA all the time. You guys had like a sign-up bonus. I would have been rich, you know. But I would refer, like, you need to go to AA. You need to go to AA. And one of the guys stayed. And he was sober like 2 years, and I ran into him, and he was a guy who I had gotten drunk with a lot. So I could see there was a change in this guy. You know, it wasn't like somebody in an AA meeting who said their life changed, and I was like, yeah, sure, you know. This guy, I actually had seen him at his bottom, and he was completely different. And he asked me a question, you know. And I have to remember this today because I know so many people who have gone, who've come and gone in AA, who I see out on the street, and I might not ask them this question, and I might not respond honestly how this guy responded to me. And he said, how are you doing? Simple question. I said, I'm doing good. I was not doing good. But what else was I going to say? I'm doing bad, you know? I said, I'm doing good. And he said, really? He said, well, you look like you're dying. And I was insulted. I was kind of with this guy who I worked with, you know, and he was in a suit. He had a girl on his arm. He had a good job. All the things I wanted. And he said, you look like you're dying. And if his response had been, that's good to hear. Good to see you, man. I would not be here today. But he said, you look like you're dying. Why don't you let me take you to an AA meeting? For some reason, I was willing that day. And I said, okay. Let's go. My last drink wasn't anything fancy. It wasn't a bad run. It wasn't, you know, I didn't steal a car and go on a high-speed chase with the police. So my last drink was 6 warm, 16-ounce Budweisers the day before that guy asked me to go to a meeting. You know, they were warm, too. It was very, very bad. That was my last drink. He asked me to go to a meeting that day, and I said yes, and he came and picked me up that night. And he took me to a meeting. And that was in May of 2005. And I've been sober since then. And it's funny, you know, my home group, some of you have been up to Midtown. It's a large group, over 300 members, sometimes touching closer to 400 people attend our home group on a weekly basis. And there are a lot of Johns at our meeting. John is a very common name, you know. So the Johns tend to get nicknames. Guys like me tend to get nicknames. And my nickname over the years of coming in and out of the meetings was 24-hour John. And we hand out these chips at our group, 24-hour chips. Oh, you want a chip? You know, 24-hour chip. Well, I had picked so many of them up, they decided to nickname me 24-hour John. So here I was coming back again for the however many time as 24-hour John. You know, nobody was betting on me to make it. Nobody thought I was going to make it. And I know that specifically because when I got sober, I didn't have anywhere to really live other than my grandfather's floor. And there was a bunch of guys who had openings in their houses for rooms to rent. And I asked all of them if I could move in, and they all said no. You know, and I know why they said no. They said no because they wanted to make sure they got their rent. And I was 24-hour John. I was the guy who never stayed sober. Something changed this time. I don't know what it is, and I say that because people ask me now as 24-hour John. You go up to my home group today and say, is 24-hour John here? They'll point to me because people still know me as 24-hour John years later. So I get a lot of new guys who are in and out kind of guys, and they'll come up to me and they'll say, hey, what's the magic? You know, what's the solution here? You've been coming in and out for all these years. What was it that finally got you to stick? And I always wish there was some sort of magical answer I could give them, something I could say that would make them get it. But for me, it was just willingness. I was willing to try something different. And it was simply because, not out of any virtue, it was because I had run out of ideas. I had completely run out of ideas on what to do. So when you said, we're going to read this blue book and we're going to do what it says, and oh, by the way, it was written in the 30s, and you're not even going to understand half of it when you first read it. It's going to have some weird things in here. You're going to have to use a pen, a pencil, and a piece of paper, and you're going to have to pray, and you're going to have to get on your knees, and you're going to have to do all this stuff. The John that came in and out would have said, no, thank you. I'll come to a couple meetings with you. I might hang out with you, but there's no way I'm diving into this. For some reason, this time, something changed. I got a sponsor, started going to meetings every day. I was a loser. I had nothing going on. A meeting every day for me, two meetings every day for me was nothing. That was fine. I called my sponsor on a daily basis, as he asked me to do, and we started getting busy. We started getting busy going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was something I had never done in the years of coming in and out of AA. I had never contemplated if there was a higher power. I had never been willing to turn my will and my life over to anything other than my own thinking. But for some reason, I became willing to do that. And that first step started to come clear in my life. Like I said, I always thought that my alcoholism was those DWIs, the blackouts, the fifth a day of vodka, whatever it was. The only problem with that is if that was my alcoholism, then me stopping drinking was a sufficient solution for it. I've never blacked out sober. You know, I've never wet the bed sober. I've never gotten arrested sober. None of this stuff has happened since I've been sober. You know, the problem is my alcoholism is more than that. It's that inability to stop. It's the fact that I will always go back. And as I started attending more meetings and listening to more people like you all talk about that, that became clear to me that maybe I needed to actually do some work if I wanted to stay sober anything longer than a couple weeks or a month, which is what I was able to do, you know, on my own, just sitting on my hands, watching movies every night with my grandfather, terrible black and white movies he would watch. It was just, you know, that was my life, you know, and we got busy. We started working through the steps, and I eventually did find somewhere to move, and my sponsor actually let me move in with him. I guess he took me under his wing, you know, and let me move in with him. And I started to see how these men were living, these sober men. They were working. They had these jobs. They showed up on time. They went to meetings. They helped other alcoholics. I started getting busy in service. I got a home group. I started setting up chairs. I started mopping the floors after our meeting. I got involved up there. Our group is so large. We have this events committee that runs. I started getting involved in our different events we do, cleaning those up, setting those up, breaking them down, doing all this stuff. I started writing my four step, something I had never done before, you know, and today, you know, I help different guys with their steps, and it's funny, you know, I did my four step in 3 days. I wrote mine in 3 days, you know, and I work with a lot of guys now, and they're like, it's like taking them 2 months, 3 months, you know, 3 months. And I'm like, have you even started yet? You know, and I say that to just say that, again, I was very willing to do something different. And at this point, I was still living on my grandfather's living room floor when I wrote my four step. I would go into the tiny bathroom in that apartment and put the toilet seat down at night, and I would just write, you know. And I was willing to do something different. And I wasn't somebody who, as I mentioned before, was raised religious. I didn't have the Christian background where I had a belief in a God. My family, my father was raised very strong in Catholic, and he had kind of gone against that at some point in his life. So he kind of pushed me away from that, you know. And so when I came into AA, I was able to be willing enough to start praying to a God that I wasn't even sure existed, that I didn't have a relationship with. But I started doing it. And the more I did it, the better it felt. And the more I connected with something, the better my life got. And it started out by just connecting with you all. I started to listen to you in your meetings. I started to feel better when I left the meeting than when I got there. I started to have these honest conversations with my sponsor about the way I was living, and I started to carry less weight around on my shoulders. He started presenting me with solutions, and I started taking actions that were working, and I started to believe in something. I came to believe through listening to you and through taking the actions that you described. And then I did this fourth step, and I did a fifth step, and I got honest with somebody for the first time ever in my life. And, you know, there were people who knew little tidbits about me, either because they were there, probably because they were there. I wasn't telling them afterward, you know. Or maybe I told them when I was drunk one night because it was a funny story. But there was a lot of stuff, including stuff that had happened to me when I was younger, through my drinking, things I had done to people that I was going to take to my grave, ways I had lived and treated other human beings that I couldn't imagine you would let me stay in AA if I told you I did it. And when I got honest with my sponsor, he didn't kick me out of AA. He didn't kick me out of his house. He just said, welcome. And he told me he loved me. And he shared some of his experiences. And I left that night feeling a little bit, I would say paranoid, I think, because I told this person all this stuff about me. But the feeling that was mainly going through me was I felt relief because I had gotten honest with somebody about all this stuff, and I felt better. And from there, I just kept going. You know, I wrote my eighth step out. Here I was. I could see that clearly through writing that inventory, I had caused a lot of damage. I had had a lot of resentments that were very unjustified, and once I talked them out through that inventory, they completely went away, and all that was really left was the truth, which was, John, you're not a nice guy who drank too much. You're not. You know, and you stay sober long enough, you start realizing that, because for me, I was still taking messed up actions after I got sober. I wasn't being fully honest. I wasn't able to show up for life all the time. I wasn't treating women with the respect I wanted to treat them with. I wasn't treating my family the way I wanted to treat them. I didn't know how to treat people. And here I am writing this list out and looking at where I can correct these wrongs and right these wrongs and repair these damages, you know. And it would have been very easy if I could have just had simple conversations with everybody and just said, I'm sorry, and that's it. But what I started to do was I started to show up for the people in my life. I started to show up for that family, you know, my mother, my father. When I had a year sober, my father, my sponsor gave me two clear, very specific instructions. He said, John, I want you to start having dinner with your father once a week, and I want you to start taking a meeting into the detox that you were a patient at three different times. And I balked at both of those. I was like, I don't want to have dinner with my father every week, and I definitely don't want to take a meeting into this detox, because I already have a Wednesday meeting that I love in AA and that I have service at. And he said what sponsors say. He said, all right, well, do whatever you want to do, you know, which is like, you better do it, you know what I mean? And that's a signal for, like, just you better do it. And I started taking a meeting into that detox, and I can tell you, report to you today, that over 13 years sober, I still take a meeting into that detox every Wednesday night, and it's one of the highlights of my life. And I have met countless men and women in that facility who today are productive members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it brings me pure joy to see them sober and happy through AA. And the second thing he told me to do was to have dinner with my father every week, and I started having dinner with this man. And it started like this. I would show up at his house, and I would show up right on, you know, on time or late. I'd knock on his door. He'd open the door. He'd let me in. I'd sit on his couch. He would have gone to the grocery store and bought all the ingredients for whatever he was cooking. He would have cooked the entire meal. He would have brought it out to me. He would have served it to me. He would have washed the dishes. I would take a nap on his couch, and I would leave. And that was me. It took me a while, but probably 6 months into this, I started changing, I guess, a little bit. And I went to my sponsor, and I was like, hey, sponsor, let me ask you something. Should I be napping and not helping my father when he cooks dinner at his house? And he said, what? You're doing what? He said, would you do that with your friends? And I was like, no, I don't. And he was like, he's like, you go there, you help him cook dinner, you ask him if he needs you to bring anything, you do the dishes, and you don't take a nap. And I was like, all right. Started bringing food, started helping him cook, started not taking a nap. I never took a nap at his house ever again. Started spending quality time with my father, and something started to change. My father and I would have dinner on Wednesdays. On Sundays, I'd call him about football. I never talked to him on the phone other than that Wednesday. After a couple years, I'd talk to him Wednesday, I'd talk to him Friday, I'd talk to him Sunday. And after a couple years more, I was talking to my father every day on the phone. He became one of the closest people in my life. We became pretty much best friends, and he knew everything about me, and he was happy to see me. And I bought dinner, I brought him food, I gave him money. I completely changed the way our relationship went, and go figure, that relationship improved. And I no longer didn't like my father. I was able to be there for him. You know, and when I had about 7 years sober, I was on a trip with a bunch of people in AA, and I came back to a phone call that my father had a massive stroke. And I remember, saying I would come to the hospital in the morning. They said he was going to be all right. And in the morning, I got another call from my uncle, and he said, your father had another massive stroke last night. He's not going to make it, you know. And I drove to the hospital that day, and I can tell you that later that night, I was sitting there holding my dad's hand when he passed away, and I knew there was nothing between us. I knew that my father was not worried about me anymore. I knew he knew that I was going to be okay. 6 months after that, my mother, who I had made amends to and started forming a relationship with, who now lived in Florida, got diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer and became paralyzed. Her whole left side of her body was paralyzed. And I was able to, through AA and talking to a sponsor and the people here, move to Florida and take care of her until I was able to move her up here and into a home that I was able to purchase because I stayed at a job long enough to have a decent credit score and have some savings. And I was able to get a home, and I was able to move my mother into that home, and I was able to take care of her for the last couple years of her life. And when she passed away in our home, in bed peacefully with her family around, I knew she wasn't worried about me anymore. I knew she knew I was going to be okay. More importantly, I knew she knew I was going to take care of my little brother. And that little brother who moved out of our house, I sat down with him to make an amends to him. And I said, Devin, I was wrong. And I was a bad example. And he looked at me and he shook his head and he said, John, I forgave you years ago when you changed. And he said, I respect you more than anybody on this earth. You know, and that, like I said, when I got sober, I didn't want any of that. The things I wanted that I saw in you were those cars you had outside, the wallet, the money you had in it, maybe the girl you had. I did not want these things. And through those things, when I tell you that AA is the most important thing in my life, that's what I mean. The most profound event that occurred in my life was a spiritual experience through making those amends. It's changed me more than anything else in this world. And through that, I had an experience one day driving down the road. It was after I'd sat down with my father, and something inside me shifted. And it's never changed back, and there's nothing anybody can do to take it away from me. And all it is I know everything's going to be okay. And I never had that when I was drinking. I never had that peace. I needed alcohol. I needed, you name it, to make me feel better. And today I know that I can be okay. My job today in Alcoholics Anonymous is to pass that on to somebody else. You know, I have a very full life today. I got a great home group in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got great friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got great guys that I work with in AA. I've got commitments that I go to. I've got people that I love dearly. I've got a relationship back with that brother. He works with me. He lives in my house. We're good friends. We hang out together. I've got an amazing life, and it's very easy to spend time in that amazing life. It's very easy to live within the gifts that I've received. My main focus today still has to be this. I still have to be willing to respond to a message from Sam and drive down here and meet with you all. And I'll tell you, when I leave here tonight, I'm going to feel better. I'm going to feel better than when I came in. I get something being in these meetings with you all. And I have to continue to give my time. What I found, the most valuable thing I have today really is my time. What am I always worried to give up? What is it? It's my time. When you ask me to do something, when a newer person in the program needs a ride, when somebody wants to meet to do some step work, whatever it is, it's really my time that I'm afraid to give up. It's the thing that I think people start to pull back away from in AA. I've done it. I'm not a perfect member of AA. I found myself in a difficult spot when my mother got sick. You know, I was running two businesses. I had basically cut my meetings back, and I was in a place where making money and the success of those businesses became my primary motivation. And I found myself moving to Florida to help my mother out. And I remember having the thought getting down there that I don't know if I need to go to AA meetings while I'm here. That's a scary thought to have at about 7 years sober. Very scary thought, you know. And God works in weird ways. I got down there. And I had the thought, you know, I'm going to go to one meeting down here just to make sure I can check that box. And I get into this meeting, and there's a girl sitting up at the front, and she shared her story. And she was sharing about relapsing after 7 years and not being able to make it back because her ego had gotten so big. She thought she had this thing, and her successes and speaking at meetings and the business she had and the relationship and all the friends, that she had somehow done this herself. And I was in the exact same spot, and it scared me, you know. And I called my sponsor that night, and I got connected down there, and I started going to meetings down there. And it's not easy. It's not easy to come back from something like that. It's not easy to, it's simple, but it's not always that easy. And I was able to get back on the beam there, and I can tell you I don't think since then I've had anything like that happen to me. I've stayed right in the middle of AA. I try to give my time to people in AA. I had a conversation with my sponsor the other day. There was a guy, I can talk about him here because he's all the way up there. There's a guy who is not your ideal new person in the program. You know, he's kind of a pain in the butt. He's just very unaware of what's going on. And he asked me to pick him up for the home group every week. And he lives about 35 minutes from where I live. I drive, pick him up, come back to the home group, drive, drop him off, come back 30-some minutes to my house. Hasn't really worked many of the steps. Kind of out there, you know, on a bunch of stuff. It's just not good, you know. But I knew I needed to say yes to pick this guy up. And I've been picking him up for the past year, and he relapsed. He went back out. And honestly, I kind of had this thought, like, I hope he doesn't come back. That was my thought. I'm being honest. I had that thought. I hope this guy doesn't call me anymore. He called me. I'm out of rehab. Can you pick me up for the meeting this Sunday? You know, and I called my sponsor, and I was like, I'm having a problem here, man. I'm not interested in helping this guy, really. And he told me a story, and I knew he would, man. He said, I got a guy just like that. And it did something for me. I said, I knew you would, you know. And he said, I kept picking him up. And I thought, well, I'm going to keep picking him up. And that's it right there, you know. Every now and then, me and that guy will have a conversation on the way back to his house from the meeting, and we'll have a real conversation. And something might get through to him, and I'll see the light maybe come on in his eyes. And I leave his house, and I can tell you that leaving that guy's house, I feel better than any amount of bonus I get at work, any, you know, new hot thing I get or toy or whatever it might be. I feel better leaving that guy's house. You know, I might not have the same excitement, but I have peace, you know. And so I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. I hope I never forget that this is what has given me everything in my life. I hope I keep saying yes to things. I'm always grateful, and I appreciate you all being very attentive tonight and listening. So, thanks.